because they have cool phones, the same great plans as Sprint and AT&T, and the expert advice to help me find what I need. And one day, I'll use the GPS on my new phone to get to my friend Orlando's wedding. But when I get there, I'll find out the wedding singer's sick, so I'll hook my phone up to some speakers, play my MP3s, get everyone dancing, and impress the bridesmaid so much so I want to go out with me. And I owe it all to Radio Shack.
Don't just buy stuff.
Do stuff.
Worn-out brakes are dangerous. When you come to a stop, are your brakes making an awful squealing noise or causing a vibration? Get to Pep Boys today and have your brakes checked by our own ASE-certified technicians. And right now, save up to $20 on any brake service after a mail-in rebate. Don't compromise the safety of you and your family. Get to Pep Boys today. And backed by popular demand, buy three tires at Pep Boys. Get the fourth one free after mail-in rebate. Some restrictions apply. Only at Pep Boys.
NASCAR Today continues on MRN Radio, sponsored by Ford F-Series, built for bold moves, built for tough.
Back at the World Center of Racing, Daytona International Speedway, after a great day of racing, Ryan Newman goes to Gatorade Victory Lane. He's won the 50th Daytona 500. We'll talk to him shortly. Right now, let's check in with Steve Post.
Joe, I'll tell you what, a man that figured in the finish there, he was in the hunt all day long. Had some things to put him in the back toward the end, had some things to put him right back up front. Mainly, it's hard driving and a good race car. Kyle Busch, congratulations on a third-place run. Or you're not smiling down here in Victory Lane. Tell us about your day.
Well, it was a good day. You know, he had the dominant car all day long, good to hold it wide open every single lap of the race. So, you know, just frustrating, to come home fourth, but that's a part of the Daytona 500 when you run as good as you had all day long. And, you know, when those guys couldn't keep up with you, but there's all those cautions at the end that propel them forward enough in order to get them, you know, fresh tires and up with us. You know, anybody could run on that stuff. So just happy about this M&M's Toyota team. The guys did an awesome job all week, all month, and preparing this thing and getting it down here. The guys in the engine shop gave us some great Joe Gibbs horsepower with Toyota. So, you know, we'll take it on and go to California and hopefully have another good one there.
If this is a bad day for him with Joe Gibbs Racing, there's a lot of good things in his future. There's Kyle Busch, top five finish here today at Daytona.
Let's pause 10 seconds for station identification on the Motor Racing Network.
The Central Valley's home for every second of action. This is NASCAR on News Talk 580 KMJ Fresno.
Let's go back downstairs to Alex Hayden.
And Kurt Busch took a champion's provisional to get in the race. You start now with a great finish here at Daytona. Your runner-up finish, Kurt. How much did teamwork actually come into play there in the closing laps?
You know, this is just unbelievable to be able to have a Penske 1-2 finish here at Daytona. I'm just, I was very emotional crossing the start-finish line, pushing Ryan Newman to the win. I feel like we have a small part in what he did today to break through, to break his drought of winless streaks, but to do it at Daytona, something very special. And so I'm happy for him and his Alltel team. Our Miller Lite Dodge did well today. We weren't good enough to win. So if that's all we could do is push a teammate to win, then that's the best effort that we could possibly have. And I'm very happy, very satisfied. Still got more years ahead of me to try to win one of these things.
Kurt Busch comes home in the runner-up position. Steve Post.
Tony Stewart, a third-place run in the Home Depot Toyota. Tony, third-place finish. Tell us about your day.
It's a good day. I mean, obviously, I thought I ran probably one of the best races of my life tonight. You know, we were just terrible at the beginning, but got good runs at the end, got a really good restart at the end, and just couldn't finish it off.
There we go. Tony Stewart, I tell you, we're talking to 2 through 5 down here, and we've got a lot of frustrated race car drivers. Let's go back to Alex Hayden.
Reed Sorensen leaning up against the target Dodge. Started fifth, brings the car home in the top five. You've had a great car all week long here in Daytona, Reed. Walk us through those last handful of laps and talk about the tough racing out there.
It was pretty fun there at the end. The track had a lot more grip there at the end, and we were able to get 2-3 wide and push each other really hard, and it happened to be about 4 Dodges lined up, so it was good, and everybody on the team did a great job. We've had a great car since we got here, and I think that says a lot about what we can do this year.
Reed Sorensen comes home in the top five. Good way to start off the 2008 Sprint Cup season for the Target Dodge team.
Great run there for Reed Sorensen, finishing in the fifth position. Again, Ryan Newman has the victory in the Daytona 500. Huge celebration. We will hear from him in just a moment.
I see you're using those new cleaning cloths we're giving away at Shell.
Yes, I am. Since Shell is passionate about ungunking your car engine, I felt we should be passionate about ungunking your car interior, too.
These are quality microfiber... Don't do that.
Oh,
sorry.
These are quality microfiber cloths that leave your car interior clean. But what really makes drivers happy is a gunk-free engine. So simply say no to gunk and fill up at Shell.
You get one cloth free with a 10-gallon purchase of Shell fuel at participating locations. Offer ends March 30th, 2008, or while supplies last.
Checkers and Rally's is taking the value menu and pumping it up with their double value menu. Jam-crammed and slammed with flavor. Mix things up with a bunch of single deals from a dollar. Grab a spicy chicken, some famous season fries, or a banana milkshake. All starting at just a buck each. And seven double deals, that's two of our famous sandwiches, for one low price. You know them, you love them, and now you can get them anytime you want. Only at Checkers and Rally's, and only on the double value menu. Little place, big taste.
After a fantastic finish in the Daytona 500, Ryan Newman is celebrating in Victory Lane. We'll go there with him shortly. From Daytona International Speedway, this is MRN Radio, the voice of NASCAR.
Reason number 13 to switch to GEICO. Everybody else is doing it. Now, we know that logic never won an argument with your mom, especially when you were lobbying for that BB gun. You could put an eye out or something. But when it comes to car insurance, joining the crowd could be a good thing. Last year, more than 3 million drivers switched to GEICO for savings, round-the-clock service, and the latest in online technology. Yep, millions switched, and nobody put a single eye out.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Mom? There's a good reason more people prefer the ease and convenience of Listerine Whitening Quick Dissolving Strips over the leading competitive strips.
Mom, you've been in there a long time.
You don't have to live in the bathroom.
I did great in grammar school.
Listerine Whitening Strips dissolve. No mess, nothing to remove.
Got my license. I shave.
Listerine Whitening Strips mean noticeably whiter teeth or your money back. So come on out.
Come downstairs and meet my wife.
Another easy way to a noticeably whiter smile is Listerine Whitening Pre-Brush Rinse.
Ray Appleton, Rush Limbaugh, and Sean Hannity. You wouldn't want to meet these guys on a racetrack, but they're pretty good to listen to when you're behind the wheel.
This is NASCAR on 580 KFJ Fresno.
It was a wild running of the Daytona 500 today. 42 lead changes among 16 different drivers. And Barney, at the finish, before we go to Gatorade Victory Lane, there's a number of guys up there in the top 15 or so that, yeah, they didn't go to Victory Lane, but they really did themselves a lot of good getting started with this new year.
Yeah, there's quite a few names in that list. Bobby Labonte is one of those. Brian Vickers, another. Sam Hornish Jr., who finished in the top 15. Robbie Gordon also comes out here in pretty good shape today. Robbie finished in eighth position. Reed Sorensen, what a day for him. He was the dark horse maybe in this thing, had a shot at it. He's going to finish fifth. Just some good to see some of these guys that really need a top 10 and 15 finish to get it in the biggest race that we run, the Daytona 500.
Yeah, it's going to be huge. And again, moving on to California Speedway next week, this will certainly give them a big boost. Let's go to Gatorade Victory Lane now.
And the Gatorade has been flowing. Ryan Newman, there were 42 lead changes. Tell us about that 42nd one and the last lap.
I mean, it's all about Kurt Busch. I got to thank Kurt. He's an awesome teammate. Couldn't have done it without him. I mean, granted, there could have been somebody else there, but they wouldn't have pushed me like he did. And got to thank everybody from Altel, Mobile One, Kodak, all the people that helped make this Dodge go fast, and the fans for coming out tonight. I hope they enjoyed the race. I know I enjoyed the last two laps.
There was so much going on those last 10 laps. Kind of take us through the last five laps and what got you in position for the win.
That restart was just plain crazy. And, you know, when everybody blocked and got three or four wide there going into one, I pushed Tony, got on Tony. Tony's a great driver. He held us straight. I couldn't afford to let off of him. And, you know, we got a good run after that with Kurt behind us. And it's just being in the right place in the right time.
How about the pit strategy today? What did you guys do on pit road? A lot of guys went two tires, no tires. Four tires. Do you guys stick with the four tires all day long?
We did four tires all day long, but the last two stops we didn't take any, and I was worried about that. But it paid off. Roy McCauley did an excellent job calling a race, and thankful to be here for sure.
You had a strong car, but when you look at how strong guys like Kyle Busch were, Tony Stewart, Dale Earnhardt Jr., are you even the least little bit surprised to be here?
No, we had a good car in the Gatorade duels, and to be standing in Gatorade Victory Lane, it's not surprising me, but man, it takes so much to get here. The pit stops were awesome. The team did a great job, and again, thank the fans for coming out. Hope they enjoyed the first new car race.
Has it settled in that you're a Daytona 500 champion and the winner of the 50th Great American Race?
Not yet, but I...
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty. On 580 KMJ.
And welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. I think I have a very entertaining show for you this afternoon, but before we get to this week's veteran, I do want to make a couple comments. First, our condolences here at KMJ go out to the family of General Ed Munger. I never had the privilege of knowing General Munger, but I heard him so many times on Ray Appleton's program and other programs here on KMJ, and it was clear whether you saw him on TV or heard him on the radio or just maybe ran into him in the community, very clear that he loved his country, he was proud of his service to our country, and he loved our valley, and we thank him for his service to our great community and to our great country. And we thank his family for sharing him with us. Also, if you saw the news this week, the airman who was frozen for 60 years in the Sierra Nevada has finally been identified, and we're very happy that the family of Ernest Glenn Munn can now have closure after their brother, there are a couple sisters still alive, their brother will finally be at rest, and they know what happened to him. That, of course, was a training mission more than 60 years ago, and our guest today didn't just fly training missions. He flew 36 combat missions with the 8th Air Force in Europe during World War II. That is Bill McLeod, otherwise known as Bomber Bill McLeod. How often do you get called Bomber Bill these days, Bill?
Whenever I go to my service club, that's how I'm referred to. They're about the only ones.
And that's the Exchange Club, right?
Exchange Club of North Fresno.
I've been there. It's a very good group, and I appreciate you inviting me after we told your story on television. Very nice group. And
thank you.
You'd have been in big trouble if I said the name of another club, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You would have had to pay a fine or something like
that. You would have been in trouble.
I would have been in big trouble. That's right. Now, Bill, you were only 20 years old when you ended up in the cockpit of a B-17, but let's start a little bit before that. Where were you when Pearl Harbor happened? What do you remember about that? And did you realize then that you'd end up wearing a uniform?
When Pearl Harbor occurred, I was a student at Texas A&M University. At that time, it was called Texas A&M College. It only had an enrollment of around 10,000. Now it has an enrollment of over 40,000. But I'd been to the movie, and when we got out, the upperclassmen met us as we got out and told us that Pearl Harbor had been attacked, and we had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. But anyway, they put us through a military routine that I just as soon forget about. And from then on, it was staying in school until we were called to active duty. In December of 42, I signed up in the Enlisted Reserve Corps as a private with the intention of going through the Aviation Cadet Program for the, at that time it was called the Army Air Force. And I was not called to active duty at that time. They said, go back to school, finish your semester, and we'll call you when we need you. Well, they needed me in February of 1943. I had just started my junior year, two weeks into it, and they called me to active duty, and I had to gave me about a week or two to settle my visits and so forth. And then we went from there to Shepherd Field. Do you want me to go through the whole list?
Well, I think you're making good progress.
Well, I went to Shepherd Field for 2 weeks, basic training. But because Texas A&M was a military school, we knew our right foot from our left foot. And we were actually ended up training some of the recruits that came in. They put us to work. And from there, we went to what was called CTD, College Training Detachment. And they sent me to Lubbock, Texas, Texas Tech University. And I was there for about 6 or 8 weeks. And we got some basic studies, mathematics, navigation. And we even did a little flight time. They gave us 6 hours of flight time in a Piper Cub. And from there, I went to...
Was that the first time that you had been up?
First time I'd been up. And I didn't throw up, so they kept me in the program.
Were you at least a little bit nervous that first time?
Yes, I'd have to say. I think all of us were a little bit nervous because it was the first time for everybody. But from there, I went to Santa Ana, California, for pre-flight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we really got into the military portion of it. And Santa Ana was a big base, huge base.
Cal Aero?
It was run by the military.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we finished our pre-flight. That was called pre-flight. And it was mostly ground school. We didn't do any flying there at all. And we were there for about 2 months. And then from there, they sent us to primary air training. And I went to the garden spot of the nation, 29 Palms, California, in July and August. real good.
But growing up in Texas, I'm sure it wasn't too hot for you.
Oh, listen, that place was terrible. That was terrible. But it was a dry heat. And we finished up primary training there in PT-17s, the old Stearman's. And from there, I went to basic training at Pecos, Texas, where I flew BT-13s. And that was a little more sophisticated airplane, had radios, and had a different type of a prop. And we had more single time than we had dual with instructor. We didn't see too much of the instructor in basic. But then I had a medical problem, which put me back two classes in Pecos, and ended up finishing my basic training at Marana Army Airfield, which is just north of Tucson, mm-hmm. Tucson, Arizona. And finished that up, and then I went to advanced flying school at Marfa Army Airfield, which is in West Texas, way out in the, well, north of, trying to think,
Waco, El Paso, Midland?
No, it's farther west. It's not as far west as El Paso. Anyway, it's in the Big Bend country out there.
With all these hot locations, you'd think they were getting ready for the Pacific or something.
You'd think so, but we were still in the Western Flying Training Command.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew UC-78s, which we called twin-engine Piper Cubs. It was a nice little airplane. It could carry about four people in it. And usually an instructor went up with two cadets. And we got our flying in, finished up our advanced flying school, and then they gave us 30 days leave before our next assignment. And I was chosen for a B-17 training, even though I'd put down that I wanted to fly an A-20. They just ignored me. That was more like a fighter than a bomber.
Well, I was going to say, this progression from Piper Cub to B-17, there's a pretty big difference there.
Listen, when I saw that first B-17, I said, that's the biggest airplane I've ever seen in my life. How are they going to expect me to fly it? Anyway, we went to Hobbs, New Mexico, and checked out B-17, and took one long flight to Los Angeles and back. With some other cadets. Well, we weren't cadets at that time. We'd received our wings, and we were all second lieutenants.
Was that a big deal to you at the time, getting those wings?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We got those at Marfa when we graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And we got our wings on April the 15th of 1944, and got our commission as a second lieutenant. And there were a bunch of fellows from Marfa that went up to Hobbs, New Mexico, and took B-17 transitional training. And then while we were there, D-Day occurred, June the 6th, 1944, but we were still waiting to go overseas. Well, foolish me, I thought, D-Day has occurred. The war is almost over. I'll never get to combat. Little did I know. Anyway.
Wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking is right. From there on, I went over to Tampa, Florida. My next assignment was Drew Field, which is right outside of Tampa. As a matter of fact, the old Drew Field is now Tampa International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And they assigned crews, B-17 crews. And there were nine of us on the crew. And we were from all parts of the country. There were no two of us from any one state. We're from all different states. The idea was that if there was a plane that went down, no one state or no one city would be more involved than anyone else.
A real comforting thought, isn't it?
Yes. So I think I was the only one from Texas at that time. And anyway, we finished our training there, which included high altitude flying, some formation flying, gunnery training for the gunners, and a bombing, practice bombing missions. And that took about 6 weeks. And then they assigned us to go to Europe, and we went over on a boat, the Ile-de-France, which carried about 15,000 troops.
And how big was your hometown in Texas?
Well, it was Dallas, Texas. It was quarter of a million.
Dallas is a little better than 15,000, but that's a whole lot of people on a boat.
You better believe it.
Or a ship. I don't want to get the Navy guys mad at me.
Yeah, it was a ship. And they had people from the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, everybody, all of the services on board. Particularly, they had a lot of nurses on board, too.
You weren't complaining about that?
No, not at that time.
Well, I think that's a good stopping point. We need to get a commercial break in, and that's a good place. When we come back, we will hear what happened once he made it across the Atlantic and was in Europe, flying out of England, flying 36 missions with the 358th Bomb Squadron of the 303rd Bomb Group of the 8th Air Force. B-17 pilot Bill McLeod, our guest. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
You've heard the phrase, love is in the air, right? What does that mean? Love is in the air. I'd like to think love is a more precious entity than some airborne thing that can haphazardly land on you. Love is something that takes time, energy, and work. Yes, you should work on love. And if you're a guy who's actively looking for love, Cupid.com is the place for you. We've got thousands of single women located in your area that are actively seeking love as well. You owe it to yourself to check it out. It's free to sign up, and from there, you can easily search the site. Find someone interesting? Contact her with one of Cupid.com's free eye contacts, or better yet, if you become a gold member, you can send her a personal message. Who knows? You may find the woman who turns out to be your one true love. The bonus is, she can find you as well. When you join, you fill out your own personal profile information, and based on what you write, your dream lady may just contact you. So what are you waiting for? Love may not be in the air, but love can, in fact, be found online.
Cupid.com. Because sometimes love is closer than you think.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tune, which our guest this week, Bill McLeod, knows all too well, Wild Blue Yonder. That's being performed there by the Sounds of Freedom Band. That's part of the Association of the U.S. Army. Locally, the Sounds of Freedom Band actually has a concert tomorrow, Monday, February 18th. That's a President's Day concert at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. That'll be at 2 o'clock if you want to go out and hear Wild Blue Yonder and all the other wonderful patriotic songs that the Sounds of Freedom Band will perform for you. We continue now with Bomber Bill McLeod. We left him on his way across the Atlantic on a big ship with about 15,000 other servicemen and a few nurses, but you couldn't pay too much attention to the nurses because you had just gotten married before going overseas, right?
That's correct. Just got married and had one day off to get married and have a honeymoon. That's all they would give me.
I've heard wives complain about short honeymoons, but I think the one night is as short as it goes.
That's about it.
Did that change your perspective at all, knowing that you had someone to go fight for and come back home for?
Well, it made me want to come back. I know that. Once I got over there, I wanted to get my missions over with and come home.
What'd you need, 25 to come home?
No, you needed 35.
35, because it had been expanded, 25
right.
Initially,
yeah.
And they expanded that to 35.
As the German Air Force was knocked out, they extended the tour of duty for the bomber crews. And by the time I got there, it was up to 35.
And you got there in 1944. In fact, your first mission was on Christmas Eve, 1944?
That's right.
What do you remember about that?
The fact that the weather in England was horrible.
Fog and more fog.
I think we had less than 50 feet visibility when we took off. And it, since I was a new crew over there, I took off and flew with an experienced crew. And the pilot of the experienced crew was taken off on instruments. Full bomb load, full gas load. I was never so scared in my life. It's the first time I'd ever done that. Believe me, I was scared.
Oh, I believe you.
With that kind of visibility, I mean, it's like the fog we had down here south of Fresno not too long ago. But at least the planes got off, which shows you the good training that the pilots had received during and before the war.
You think your crew was as scared as you were?
Well, they took off with another crew, with another pilot, an experienced pilot.
Mm.
And I think they were just as scared as I was. But anyway, we took off and got above the fog and got up to about 10,000 feet. And this was the day before Christmas, 1944. And we noticed that the gas cap on one of the gas tanks was loose and water was flowing, or gasoline was flowing out of it. So, and shortly after that, the prop ran away on one of our engines, so we knew we couldn't proceed with the bombing mission. So we had to look all over England and find an airfield that was open and make an emergency landing and go in there, and that's where we spent Christmas Eve night, because we couldn't get back to our base, not until the next day.
But that must have been a little nerve-wracking.
Not only nerve-wracking, we were hungry. They didn't feed us. Everybody else got a nice Christmas meal. I think we didn't get anything. We didn't get anything until we got back to our base.
But you were thankful at least that you found a place to land, I imagine.
There was one field that was open. It was the home of the 100th Bomb Group. And we landed there. And they had to leave the airplane there, but they sent a 6x6 truck from our base at Molesworth to pick us up and got us back to England. And it took a while to get there because it was still foggy. Still foggy.
Might have been more dangerous for you on the ground in that fog than it had been in the air.
It might have been, especially if we'd been on the Highway 99.
Well, I'm glad you weren't. You made it back to your base there in Molesworth, as you mentioned, and you flew quite a few more missions. And I want to tell our listeners, if they want to learn more about your group in particular, even your squadron, they can find a picture of your crew, read about the different missions that you went on, and that entire 303rd Bomb Group. A great website. It's 303rdbg.com. That's 303rdbg.com. And it tells the whole story of the Hell's Angels,
right,
as you guys were known. Did you like the fact that you're part of the Hell's Angels?
It didn't register with me at all, to tell you the truth. We got the name. The group was named after one of the bombers, one of the original bombers that went over, and it was named Hell's Angels. And as soon as it completed 25 missions, they sent it back to the United States on a war bond tour. And it was the first B-17 in the 8th Air Force to complete 25 missions.
A lot of the other ones were shot down before they got that far.
Yeah. But
And I bet you were somewhat glad, because early on in the war, you heard about all these B-17s getting shot down, and the crews are either killed or they become POWs.
Casualties were very high at the beginning.
Then they got those fighter escorts over there. You've got P-47s alongside, P-51s in some cases, and I bet that made you breathe a little easier than the guys who had preceded you.
By the time I got over there in 1944 and 45, we had good protection, primarily from the P-51s. They had converted a number of P-47 groups to P-51s because they had greater range. It could go farther into Germany and could go to Russia. It escorted some bomb groups to Russia. But it had just as much firepower as a P-47. Now, I don't mean to denigrate the P-47 because it was an excellent airplane, and we got lots of aces.
Well, and I was going to mention, I just spent last weekend with a few of them. They had a symposium up in Sacramento with four P-47 aces, three of them who have ties to the Valley. A couple of them live in Fresno, Ed Roddy and Hal Comstock, and General Les Smith used to live in Carruthers, went to Fresno State, ended up as an ace as well. And they would say that the P-51 versus P-47 argument, that's holy ground right there. P-51 might have been faster and more powerful and more range, but was not as durable and couldn't take the beating that the P-47 could with its radial engine.
That's true. That radial engine was real strong. And once you got a hole in that Allison liquid engine, you better look for a place to land.
But you were thankful to have fighter escort, regardless who it was, because right. if you had to depend on the gunners on your plane, it might have been a long trip a few times.
Yes, it was. Fortunately, during my missions, I didn't see any German fighters. I didn't see them personally, but it was a German fighter that shot my plane down, and I'll tell you about that later.
All right, we're building a little bit of suspense about shooting his plane down. Was he on the plane when it was shot down or not? And, you know, a lot of people get this idea about a pilot in World War II, and they think he bonds with his plane and he's flying the same plane every mission. And you were fortunate enough to fly the same plane on, I think, 15 of your missions.
Right.
But you flew planes called Shasta, Emma, Sky Demon, Hens, Revenge, Sweet Rose O'Grady, but none of those were your favorite, huh?
No. They really didn't mean a thing to me until I got my own plane and I could name it myself. But you're right. After I'd flown about 12 or 15 missions, I flew over to Burton Wood and picked up a brand new airplane, flew it back, and I asked operations if I could have the airplane, and they agreed with me. So we flew that until the time that I'd had 25 missions under my belt. And when I say I include the crew.
Right.
Then we went to what was called a rest home, or a flak home, for 1 week, and slept as late as you wanted, had home-cooked meals, had some recreation, things like that. So while I was there, another crew came along and took up my airplane.
And this airplane, you called it Lil Bit?
Lil Bit.
And where did that come from?
It came from my navigator. We gave him the privilege of naming the airplane. We took the very democratic way.
Drew Straws?
Drew Straws, yeah. And he won, and he named it after his wife. Anyway, while we were there, another crew took it up on a mission to Hamburg, Germany. And an ME-262, those jet fighters, you know, came through the formation and shot my airplane down. And I think there were three killed in action. The rest of them ended up as prisoners of war. This was about March of 1945.
And how soon after that did you hear about it? Was it immediate that you found out about it?
As soon as I got back to the base. Yeah. And then I flew any airplane that was available.
I bet that really got your attention, though, at the time.
Anytime you had an airplane shot down, it got your attention.
Especially when it was your airplane. It could have been you a week earlier.
We considered it ours, but actually it was the crew chief's airplane. We just borrowed it to fly it.
And he made sure that you remembered that.
Yeah. Good crew chief. They were all good.
Did you ever encounter a 262 on any of your missions?
Never saw a German fighter. For that, I'm thankful.
Oh, I don't blame you. You did, however, get hit by a little bit of ground fire. And I want to talk about one of those missions when we come back for this next segment here, because I know it's very memorable to you and to a particular member of your crew. We're visiting with World War II B-17 pilot Bill McLeod. You're listening to Hometown Heroes this afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ.
What would it take for you to try a new diet supplement?
If it worked without making me jittery.
If it was truly different and not some gimmick.
I don't like feeling hungry and irritable. I really don't.
I don't want to look flabby or be tired.
Great news, America. We asked and you told us. And the result is Hydroxadrine, a brand new stimulant-free diet supplement that combines four powerful formulations to fight food cravings, burn fat, and enhance mood and energy. So not only will you look great, but you'll feel great. In fact, we're so confident that you'll lose the weight you want to lose without cravings and without feeling tired and depressed that we're making available an unprecedented risk-free 30-day trial. Finally, a diet supplement made especially for you. Call 1-888-690-8257. That's 1-888-690-8257. Call now, 1-888-690-8257. Again, 1-888-690-8257.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lattler on News Talk 580 KMJ. Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Lattler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back. back to Hometown Heroes on this Sunday afternoon. I'm Paul Leffler coming to you from Radio City, and my guest this week is Bill McLeod, B-17 pilot during World War II. You've heard him talk about a few of his missions, but on his third mission of the war, and we heard him talk about his first was Christmas Eve 1944, couldn't complete the mission, and had to land at another base they weren't familiar with. It was such a foggy day that day, and they ran into a little trouble. The third mission, I guess you had an addition to your crew? Is that what you wanted to talk about with that?
No, not necessarily. The third mission was to target by the name of Noose, which was a rail marshaling yards behind the front of the Battle of the Bulge.
That's right. So this was actually just a week later, New Year's Eve, 1944.
This was New Year's Eve, the last day of the year. And at that time, all of our missions were to help the enlisted soldiers on the ground during the Battle of the Bulge,
which had been going for about 2 weeks at that point.
It started December 16th.
Right.
And as you say, it's been going for a while. But we wanted to destroy the facilities that they had there behind the lines where they were bringing in their supplies for the German military. And so that was our target. And it was a tiny little target. It wasn't real big. But what amazed me was the accuracy of the anti-aircraft. And as we came in, we could see the anti-aircraft exploding ahead of us. And it was right at our altitude.
So this is just little puffs of black smoke?
Right. Usually in four puffs, because batteries are usually four guns to a battery. And they would be getting closer and closer. And finally, they were in the formation. They got us right in the formation. And that's where my bombardier got the Purple Heart, because some slivers of steel exploded and came into the nose of the airplane. And by the way, bombardiers were more casualties than any other position on the airplane during World War II. Anyway, he got hit with exploding plexiglass, which got into his eyes and his head, and he wouldn't leave his position. He stayed there until it was time for bombs away, and we told him when to drop the bombs, and he flipped the switch, and then we took him back to the radio room where he received first aid.
Now let me go back a little bit. So you're flying along, and you had seen the target. It's just a little tiny spot on the ground. You probably didn't anticipate a whole lot of anti-aircraft fire there?
Not from that target.
Had you run into this is only your third mission, so
yeah,
you hadn't been prepared for a whole lot. And then you see it at your altitude, and so you know that you're flying straight toward it. Somebody who's not familiar with this might say, well, why didn't you just peel off or go the other way? That wasn't an option, was it?
That was no option at all. You stayed in formation because you had to put your bombs on target.
So it didn't matter how much flak was coming, your formation had to stay on target. You had to keep that separation with the other planes and
right,
keep your bearings.
Yep, and we tried not to look at the anti-aircraft coming. We had to look at the lead airplane to stay in formation with him. There was no automatic pilot that kept you in formation. You had to look over there and do it yourself. Besides that, there was no hydraulic help from the airplane. It was just like driving a Mack truck. So you really had a workout.
You had to be in pretty good shape and be pretty strong,
yeah,
to work all of that.
Yeah.
So the plane gets hit. And obviously this is your third mission. Again, it's not something you'd been prepared for, really.
That's right.
What did that sound like? Were you worried that the engines were going to get hit? What was that?
I was worried that the people were going to get hit. Yeah. But we could hear the flak hitting the airplane. It was like gravel, throwing a handful of gravel at the plane. But fortunately, we just had one Purple Heart, and that was the only Purple Heart in all of my missions that I flew.
So he has plexiglass in his eyes, can't see a thing.
Yeah.
And
blood is flowing into his eyes.
But he didn't leave his station. He stayed right there.
He wouldn't evacuate. Yeah.
Did any of you tell him that he should?
We tried to get him to leave, but he wouldn't. By the way, his name was Duke O'Donnell, and he was from Joliet, Illinois.
And now he lives down in Southern California.
Right.
You keep in touch. What did that mean to you when he refused to leave and was determined to stay there and fulfill his duty? Was that inspirational to you?
Well, it had to be inspirational, and I was I very much admired Duke for that. And I put him in for a medal after we got down, and then it was turned down. And later on in life, I got him the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Which, for those who aren't familiar, is one of the more prestigious awards that you can earn flying for the U.S. military.
And that was in addition to the Purple Heart.
So we got a Purple Heart and a DFC, and the respect of his crew, certainly. And you probably can't think of too many instances. I imagine we couldn't get too many stories if we put a survey out there of blind bombardiers who hit their targets.
Well, that's very true. As a matter of fact, we had one in our group, a bombardier, who practically did the same thing, and he got the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Hmm.
That was earlier before we got there. And they named an airfield after him in West Texas, Jack Mathias.
Wow. And these stories, and, you know, a lot of guys feel like they didn't do anything, and they'll point to a story like that and say, now that's really something. But the fact that all of you were there, and all of you would have done that exact same thing, I think, when I talk to you and I hear the attitude and the love you have for your country, and I can see how that's a very memorable day for you during your experience. So that was only your third mission. You had 33 left after that.
That's right.
And you had talked about getting a chance to go home once you hit 35.
Yeah.
But you ended up flying 36.
Right.
And I know there's a story there.
There's a story there. It pertains to the fact that when I got into the airplane and we took off, I noticed that the oxygen level was not full. So I aborted the flight, came back and landed, and they tried to put us on another airplane. And I told them that there wasn't enough oxygen for the number of hours we were going to be above 12,000 feet. But the engineering officer checked the system out while we were up on our second attempt and said there was nothing wrong with it, and so I was penalized. They penalized the pilot.
He thought you were making it up, or you just misread it, or what?
He didn't say. He just said it was okay.
So here you think, okay, this is it, number 35. I get to go home and see that wife who I had one day with after we were married before I shipped out. And then they said, one more.
Mm-hmm.
When you took off for that number 36, were you thinking, I really wish I could have gone home after 35. I don't know what's going to happen here.
You better believe it. I was real anxious.
Now, we'll get a commercial here in a couple minutes. I want to ask you a little more about what it was like up there in the sky, because people think, oh, you're flying around, this is an adventure, you know, you've got targets to hit, and maybe there's anti-aircraft fire, maybe there are fighters coming at you, but just the atmosphere itself inside the airplane, I mean, this is no picnic.
No.
The altitude that you're flying at, and these are not pressurized cabins like we have today, what were those conditions like? And keep in mind, this is in Europe in the middle of winter.
That's right. Yeah, I flew in the winter of 44-45, which was one of the most severe winters that they'd had over there at that time.
The guys that were on the ground at the Battle of the Bulge will tell you that.
That's right. Most of my missions were flown in the area of 25,000 feet. And you're right, we did not have any pressurization, so we had to wear oxygen masks. And we were on oxygen for anywhere from 5 to 7 hours on an average flight. So it got a little old after a while.
And a little cold, probably, too.
Well, I was never cold, personally, because we had heated flying suits that they issued to us. And fortunately, I got one that worked every time. Some of the fellows got some that didn't work. Then they had a problem. But I had good suits all the time, and I was nice and comfortable. And we had gloves, fur-lined flying boots, and flying jackets and so forth over our flying suits. So we were kept pretty warm. And when we came down from altitude, we could, about 12,000 feet, we could take off our oxygen mask. And the first thing everybody did at those days was pull out a cigarette, take a smoke. That was our something to keep us from falling apart. Get rid of stress. That was our stress remover. And also we had sandwiches that were provided for us, and our engineer would put them into a heated hand warmer and turn the heat up on that with a rheostat, you know, and heat those sandwiches. And boy, were they good. Best sandwiches we ever had. We were starving when we came down from a mission.
Oh, I imagine.
Because we didn't have anything to eat. We didn't have anything to drink. And that was for 4 or 5 hours. So we were looking forward to coming back down in one piece, that is.
Yes, the alternative would certainly not be nearly as attractive.
That's right.
Well, we have plenty more to talk about. Bill's days in the air actually weren't done after that 36th combat mission. He would go back to Europe and spend some time in the skies. We'll talk about that a little bit and other memories from his service during World War II. He's Bill McLeod, B-17 pilot. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Hi, folks. Dan Gamble for Dan Gamble's RV Centers. We had no idea that so many people would come to our recent RV auctions. Well, guess what? You gave us a new idea. We've made Bid and Buy another way to purchase your new RV every day at all Dan Gamble's RV centers. And when you visit us at Gamble.com, you can click on the Bid and Buy link, select your RV, and submit your bid just like an auction. RV with me, Dan Gamble, and take your family on a green vacation.
You know, Helen, I thought figuring out our rights with Medicare would be easy, but that just isn't the case.
Oh, dear, I wish I could help, but I'm confused too.
There has to be someone who can help us out.
There is someone who can help you understand your Medicare rights. Lumetra, a nonprofit organization under contract to Medicare, offers comprehensive information regarding your Medicare rights and free assistance with hospital discharge appeals and quality of care complaints. Call Lumetra at 800-841-1602, 800-841-1602, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or on the web at www.lumetra.com. That's L-U-M-E-T-R-A.com.
Helen, I'm going to call Lumetra right away.
I feel better already, dear.
Lumetra helps you understand your rights under Medicare. Paid for by Lumetra, under contract with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Don't forget that concert tomorrow at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building, 2 o'clock. The Sounds of Freedom Band from the Association of the U.S. Army. Great local band that spans different generations, from the greatest generation down to the latest generation. They'll enjoy having you at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building tomorrow. Bill goes to a class, actually, at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building on Monday mornings, a great veterans class down there. And also another event coming up in that same complex on March the 8th. If you're a veteran, a military retiree, and you're not sure what benefits are available to you, there will be a veterans benefits seminar on March the 8th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. there at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. Okay, let's continue now with Bill McLeod, who flew 36 combat missions in Europe with the 358th Bomb Squad of the 303rd Bomb Group in the 8th Air Force, and that included a couple of missions over Dresden. One was bombs, one was something else, and you knew the war was coming to an end. At least you said you thought it was going to end by the time you got over there, but now it seemed pretty clear that Hitler couldn't last too much longer.
Well, he managed to last almost to the very end, but our bomb line extended, kept going farther and farther into Germany, which meant our missions were going farther and farther into Germany and getting longer and longer. I'll never forget my last mission, which was 10 and a half hours, which is a long time to be in the air.
That puts the deep in deep penetration.
It
huh?
sure does, and that took us almost to the boundaries of Czechoslovakia. But prior to that, on February the 14th and 15th, this is controversial to some people, but our target was Dresden, and the people keep asking what was the target with Dresden, because it was such a wonderful city. It was a tourist city. Well, it wasn't so much a tourist city. They had a lot of industry there, small industry. They contributed to the German bomb military effort. And the Russians had asked us to drop a few bombs on Dresden. And the first bomb was on February the 14th, and that was a mission I flew, and we dropped
leaflets.
Yeah, good thing of leaflets
to warn the people.
No,
to educate the people.
No, that was to tell them what was going on in the east. And I used to have a couple of copies of those leaflets, and I don't know what's become of them now.
But so the this second is to tell them that the Russians are getting closer,
yeah,
from the east.
Yeah, storm from the east. That was the name of it. And the Russians were getting close too. The second bombing mission was on the 15th of February, 1945, and on that one I dropped bombs. And the main target that we tried to hit were the railroad stations and places where the boxcars were. And unfortunately, there were a lot of refugees who were coming into Dresden driven by the Russians from the east. And that's where the people were a little disgusted that we had bombed. But we had no idea that there were so many refugees coming in. And our intelligence had no advance notice on that. But anyway, that was one of the memorable bombing missions. And another one was on the Ruhr when we had to go over the target twice. And for what reason, I do not know. But the leader of our squadron that day was Werner Goring, who was the nephew of Hermann Goring, the leader of the Luftwaffe. He had become an American citizen when his father left Germany about 1935 because he didn't like what was going on at that time. So he came over and settled in Wisconsin or Michigan or one of those states up there. Anyway, Werner was a good pilot, and he became a lead pilot, and he was leading the squadron at that time. But something happened. We had to go around and go through that flak twice, but we only got credit for one mission.
And I'm sure when you came the second time around, you're saying under your breath, this better not be it. We better not get hit here. I'm curious about Werner Goring, because you hear lots of stories, and I've talked to several veterans, whether they be Japanese Americans, Italian Americans.
Yeah.
A lot of them were assigned specific places because of their heritage, and people were afraid. They didn't want to put them in the same area where that heritage might change their allegiance, so at least in theory. It was a disrespect to the veterans, the soldiers themselves, to think that. But I'm somewhat surprised that you have here the nephew of the head of the Luftwaffe, and here he is leading a bomb squadron?
He's a lead pilot.
Obviously, none of you who knew him had any concerns about his allegiances.
No. There's a story about it, but I'm not going to tell it, about how he was, how the FBI had pilots in the airplane prepared to shoot him if he did anything wrong.
How did you find that out?
From the guy that had the gun.
Wow. So a member of the crew.
Right. He was his co-pilot.
Had those instructions.
Yep.
That if he does anything that's not following orders.
Kill him.
Take him out.
Yep.
Wow.
But he was a very loyal American. He did a good job.
Did he ever find out about those guys on his plane?
I don't know that.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that they never had to do that.
I'm glad they did, too.
But it's,
he's retired now. He went into the real estate business over in Arizona after the war, and now he's retired and living in, I think he's living in Tucson.
Now, speaking of guys retiring and whether they're still around or not, I realize that your crew, which was 9 at the time, obviously you've lost a few of those guys. There are 4 of them left now. What's it like when you go to a reunion and you see these guys again? Is it like being in 1945 all over again?
No. It's not like 1945. We stuck together pretty close. But, you know, we've all made other new friends, and we tend to stay with them, too, especially if they're from your same town that you're from. And that seems to be the case with a number of people. Although Duke, my bombardier, and I are very close. And I have a waste gunner who lives in Venice, Florida. He's only been to one reunion. And my co-pilot lives down in Northridge, California. And he's been to a number of reunions, but I haven't seen him for the last 3 or 4 years.
Now, the last reunion, and like so many veterans organizations from World War II, some of them are starting to disband because the membership has just shrunk so much. But your last reunion, you decided to bring some guests along with you. Tell me why you did that.
Well, I brought all my family for the simple reason that they had never been to a reunion. They didn't know what it was all about. The only one that did was my oldest son, and he had been with me for about 3 or 4 reunions, make sure I didn't stumble, and he was there to pick me up if I did. But it was a wonderful experience and probably one of the best vacations that we took as a family. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. We took a lot of pictures and went to a lot of places. Went to Mount Vernon one day, and then we went to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. We went to the World War II Memorial, where we had our memorial service.
Had you been there before?
No, I never had.
What was that like for you?
It was very impressive, very, very impressive. And then while we were there, we saw Bob Dole and his wife Elizabeth, who was escorting another group from her state of North Carolina to the Veterans Memorial. And Bob Dole came over to our group as we were waiting for our bus, and we took pictures of him. And he was very very happy to see us. You know, he's a veteran of World War II.
Oh, absolutely.
And we got to meet the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force, Mike Mosley, and he and I went to the same school together.
Hmm.
Not at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. I was class of 45. He was class of 71.
A few years different.
Yeah.
What did it mean to you there at the World War II Memorial? I know we're getting short on time here, but when you look at all those gold stars and what they represent, the price of freedom,
yeah.
Did you think of guys that you knew during the war?
Not necessarily. I kind of lumped it into the big picture. All the people who were in the war. Not necessarily individuals. Because, as you know, there were 16 million Americans in uniform in World War II. And we lost a lot of people.
400,000.
It was a dedication to them. It was in their memory.
Well, we've got about a minute left in the program here. I want to give you a chance. I know that obviously taking your family to that reunion, it was important for you that they know what you did and what guys like you did. If a high school student comes to you right now and says, why are we fighting in World War II? Why did you go fly that airplane and fly 36 missions? What's your answer for that?
We were attacked. We were attacked. It was a sneak attack in Pearl Harbor. And what else are you going to do? You got to fight back. So we got stabbed in the back, and we turned around like a vicious tiger. And if you see the movie Tora, 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 at the very end, old Admiral Hirohito says we've unleashed a tiger after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and that's exactly what happened.
That is exactly what happened. We're out of time for this week. Thanks to Bill McLeod for being here. Thank you for your service, Bill. This has been Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
If you own a home in the Fresno area, I'm telling you, you have a ridiculous opportunity to lock in a fixed-rate mortgage as low as 5.5% with an APR of 5.6. Did you hear that? 5.5%. Today's rates have just hit a 3-year low. I'm Hayes Barnard, owner of Paramount Equity Mortgage, and the fact is, we are one of the only mortgage banks in the country that can truly deliver these rates and the flexible programs you need to put money back in your pocket every single month. Don't be paralyzed by the negative housing stories. If you need to jump out of a rising adjustable, jump right now. Our 5.5% rate can save you an outrageous amount of money. There's zero out-of-pocket expenses, and I'm going to pay for your home to be appraised. So make one simple 5-minute call right now to 456-6000. And when you like it, lock it while you can. Paramount Equity is committed to saving our neighbors money. Call 559-456-6000.
Licensed by the Department of Corporation.
It was really easy.
It was simple. Even I can do it.
This year, do your taxes with TurboTax Online. It does all the hard work for you. You just answer simple questions, and it automatically fills in all the right forms. With eFile Plus Direct Deposit, there's no easier way to get your refund.
They made it really easy.
TurboTax. Choose easy. Now get the Federal Free Edition at TurboTax.com. Appropriate for the majority of returns.
You know, the Choice Privileges Rewards Program is really rolling out the welcome mat to guests of Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels. See, this spring, you'll earn up to triple points. And with all you folks earning free nights faster, we're going to need a big welcome mat, like see it from the moon big. Maybe I should look into that. In the meantime, you should call 800-4-CHOICE or visit choicehotels.com. We'll see you there.
Earn 5 base points, 5 bonus points, and 5 more points for registering.